Hi, I'm Dr. Pam Peek, and welcome to episode 60 of Her, the podcast all about women, where we share the naked truth about her mind, her body, and her life. Wow, today we have a very, very special guest. We're going to be talking about addiction and healing and trauma. Wow, it's quite a mix. But before we hop in there, one of the things I want you to know is that this episode of Her is made possible by our wonderful friends at Smarty Pants Women's Complete Vitamins. They are delicious once-a-day gummies that contain the complete vitamin, mineral, folate, and omega mix customized for women. So you won't forget to take them because they taste so great. Learn more by going over to SmartyPantsVitamins.com. And just a quick reminder to hop on over to iTunes after our episode to rate this podcast and review us, because guess what? I read these things. In my spare time. Want to hear from you. Your feedback means absolutely everything. All right, it's time for Her.
Her, the podcast.
The naked truth about women.
Her mind.
Her body.
Her life. It's all about Her.
Wow. I'm going to tell you that we are so delighted and honored to have with us today someone that the grand majority of us know so well from her marvelous work in Hollywood, as well as an amazing professional twist to her career as well. It's Mackenzie Phillips. Yeah, Mackenzie Phillips is a daughter of John Phillips and stepdaughter of Michelle Phillips, both lead singers of the 60s band The Mamas and the Papas. She starred as Julie Cooper Horvath on the sitcom One Day at a Time alongside Valerie Bertinelli. Today, Phillips works at Breathe Life Healing Center in West Hollywood as a substance abuse counselor. She's the author of the 2009 memoir High on Arrival. And now her new book, Hopeful Healing, Essays on Managing Recovery and Surviving Addiction, is out and is really lighting up the social media sphere, as it were. Mackenzie, wow. Welcome to the Her podcast.
Thank you so much. It's so lovely to be with you today.
Oh, boy. All right. So here I have this book in front of me. And it's really a mind blower. And this is Hopeful Healing, Essays on Managing Recovery and Surviving Addiction. And, you know, it's interesting. I immediately, when I was reading through, there's just so much here that is so practical and beautiful. And it just seems like you've had quite the life journey. And I really resonated with that one part of this book in particular, 50 years of denial on abuse and trauma, and that beautiful little quote, I wonder how much of what weighs me down isn't mine to carry, by anonymous.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep.
So what's that about? Why did you really write this book? I mean, this memoir you wrote in 2009 was a mind blower. It was like, wow, okay, now we get it. So you went through a hell of a journey with addiction. And this goes deeper into this. It goes into the healing and recovery process and really links it up with trauma. Am I reading that right?
Yes, absolutely. You're reading it 100% right.
So why did you write Hopeful Healing? What did you really want to get out of this? What was your...
High on Arrival was a certain type of book. You know, it was a memoir, and it really did... help a lot of people, especially people who are survivors of sexual abuse, and brought a lot of, you know, untreated addicts into recovery. And as I was sort of going through my life, you know, I'm 57 now, but, you know, I was thinking, wow, I am certainly not going to be alive as long as I already have been. What am I passionate about? What do I want to do with the rest of my life? Do I want to follow expectation? Would be for me to continue working as an actress and sort of, you know, pounding the pavement, auditioning for roles, and so on and so forth? Or what is it that I would really love to do that I've always thought I couldn't do because of expectation? And I remembered and realized that I love working with others. When I was a little kid, I wanted to be a psychologist. But the acting train pulled into town, and I rode that train for many decades, and it was a good ride. I was very successful. But once I was settling into my, you know, they call it midlife, but frankly, it's not midlife. Because there's no middle here. I'm not going to be alive until I'm 117 or 40, you know, whatever. I thought, right. Well, I'm going to go back to school, and I'm going to work with addicts and alcoholics. I love to work in the treatment facility. And so that's what I did. And as I was, you know, gaining the clinical knowledge to be able to, you know, have a one-on-one session in my office with a client with the door closed, you know, doing what I love, I was thinking, wow, I not only now am I experientially an expert, but I have the clinical training to back it up. And I feel like I had some hard-won practical, like you said, practical wisdom to share with people. And so I sat down and started conceptualizing Hopeful Healing and what that might look like and what the best format to put it in was when I came up with essays. And that's where Hopeful Healing came from. It sort of came as a natural progression of my journey through life.
Oh, I just love it. And, you know, it's also practical. It's almost like you're there in the room, you know?
I wanted the tone to be very conversational. I wanted the tone to be very conversational. I wanted it to be, like you said, like we were just sitting there talking about stuff. I didn't want to come from a place of, you know, there's plenty of, you know, how-to books on recovery that come from a place of authority. I wanted to come from a place of, yeah, man, me too. Hey, I experienced that. Here's what I did when that happened to me. You might want to try it.
You know, and I think that gives you street cred, you know, when you're talking to your clients. Because, you know, instead of someone pontificating from on high, you're saying, been there, done that. Let me tell you what worked for me. Let me also tell you what's really tough. Because, you know, you also note in here this whole issue of relapse. What happens with relapse? Actually, at the end of the book, a note about relapse was I thought just absolutely beautiful, because you know you're so real about this. You say the world can be a super harsh place, and people are people, fallible and fragile. This book is a guide to loving yourself and loving people, no matter what your history, your story tells you about your vulnerability. And you talked about the big difference when your mom passed away and when your dad passed away, and that relapse was associated with your father's passing, but not with your mom's. What was that about?
Well, I think, you know, I mean, obviously it was about a lot of different factors came into play there. You know, when my father died, I felt as though I would be set free. You know, almost like a ding-dong, the witch is dead, although, I don't think of it that way anymore. and I thought that would sort of be, you know, my emancipation, if you will. And when it did actually happen, I felt bereft and I felt lost and I felt very confused because, like I say in the book, the wires of love and devastation, they were so tangled and the messages right. were so crossed and screwed up. And I found myself thinking, well, now what am I going to do? Now who's going to tell me why? Because I never said why. Why did you do this to me? Why? You know, and then I thought, well, now I'm never going to get the answer. And then I cried and I wept and, you know, all these things went through my head. And then I ultimately realized that I had the answer and that I didn't need the perpetrator or my father, if you will, to be there to give me the answer, that, you know, I already had it within me. But that was frightening to me, and I felt really adrift, and it was easy for me to go back to using. Whereas when my mom passed, and I think it also has to do with time and grace, you know, when my mom passed, it was just such a different experience. I mean, it was almost beautiful. And so for many, many years, I'm my father's daughter. I'm a Phillips, you know. This is who we are, and this is how we are, and this is just the way it is. And in the end, final years of my mother's life, I began to realize I have been identifying with the wrong parent all along. I used to say, I am my father's daughter. No, I am my mother's child. And it was very beautiful for me to understand that I could shift my state of being to a place that would allow me to re-identify with the parent that was more influential in my life, and let go of this long-held belief that was very rigid, you know, that I was willing to re-examine.
Wow, and you basically reframe, just like we do now in trauma therapy. Speaking of which, talk to us about this abuse and trauma. This is, you know, hit the media. This whole issue that you bring up is so powerful. You know, 59% of young people with childhood trauma and abuse and or abuse, you know, it's all the same, end up developing substance abuse problems. And the majority of those who do are female. So,
yes.
I mean, you call yourself, you say, so I was a statistical probability. Good to know. What had happened? When did you finally realize, because you said 50 years of denial, when did it all come together that what you say here so strongly in this chapter, in this section, is that until you put that trauma on the table, until you examine it and confront it, you could do all the rehab and all the recovery type of practices you want, but you won't get there. What happened?
Well, here's what I want to say about that, is that I really thought that, you know, in treatment, in the first 30 days, you know, it was time to, like, regurgitate my trauma, you know, and let it all out and lay it all out on the table. And, you know, what I didn't realize was that by doing that so early in my recovery, over and over again in treatment, I was literally re-traumatizing myself, you know, and that when you're telling your story from the cave, if you will, because I like to look at it as like, you know, when one is in active addiction, you're living in the cave, right? It's comfy, it's dark, it's warm, it's like, oh God, you know, it's pretty bright out there outside this cave. I kind of like it in here. So when you're in early recovery, you're still sort of in the cave and you're in treatment. And so this idea that we should, you know, use CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy in the first 30 days with a client and have them regurgitate all their trauma, it reinforces leading with the wound, right? You following me here?
Right, absolutely.
And so what I found, what I realized in my work with this amazing clinician who's my clinical supervisor, her name is Kathleen Murphy, she's brilliant, and also through Janina Fisher, who is an amazing doctor working with trauma, that the time to tell your story isn't the day you arrive or in the first 30 days or maybe even the first 60 days. That's the time, because Bessel van der Kolk talks about how the body keeps the score.
One of the best books I have ever read. Absolutely.
I love that book with all my heart. He talks about how trauma survivors don't have memories necessarily. They have symptoms. So it becomes, you know, you identify your trauma through the symptoms rather than the memory. And then you deal with the symptoms of the trauma till you get the person to the point where they're capable of dealing with the memory. And so I was doing it backwards all along, and I was at treatment centers that allowed me to do it backwards all along. Do you see what I'm saying? And I
never really had
the opportunity. Oh, my God, and the world just opened up like a beautiful flower for me. Now that I have this information and this understanding and this awareness, working with my clients on stuff like this is a completely different experience than the kind of treatment modality that I have experienced most times that I went to treatment. And it's really kind of freeing.
Bessel van der Kolk, I want to make sure everyone gets a chance to, you know, probably grab that book if they don't have it. It's called The Body Keeps the Score. And this is a colleague of mine whose name is Dr. Bessel van der Kolk. He's actually up in Boston, has a big trauma center up there. And this book is an easy read. And when you mentioned the thing about the symptoms, I recall one example he gave in the book. You know, he's a real yoga fanatic and got it going up there in the trauma center, and really, really is an advocate. And noted that in a yoga class, one of the women who was doing the poses and back and forth, you know how the teacher will come around and correct you oftentimes, you know, maybe realign you, get that posture going. But he touched her and completely flipped her out. And because touch to her.
The trauma was reactivated.
Absolutely. We're right back to go again. And that's when Bessel began to realize, oh, my God, this is so big. We have to be, you know, we have to become more trauma-centric. We have to understand how this works, which also, you know, it's interesting. I don't know if you've ever had a conversation with Anna Forrest, who wrote the book Fierce Medicine, and she actually developed a yoga that is trauma centric. She's a yoga master, and based upon her incredibly terrible upbringing, I mean, it was like what else could possibly happen to this child? And somehow she survived, and yoga helped her to be able to navigate those treacherous waters as she was going through her thing. One other is, and I'm not sure if you've read this one, this is Christine Courtois, who wrote the famous text, Complex Trauma. And as a counselor and many professionals out there, this is a really marvelous reference to be able to understand how to begin to understand and parse apart the categories of trauma, because it's not all the same. It's not vanilla. There's a huge spectrum of experience. But when you wrote in your beautiful book, Hopeful Healing, about your own experience, you know, you could really see your mind opening up to how to confront trauma, how to get in touch with the symptoms, because it's a long journey, isn't it?
It is, and you know, I suppose it's not a bad thing that it's a long journey, because anything worth, you know, striving for is generally something that doesn't happen overnight, you know? And it's been an incredible journey for me, from this young woman where people would say, what is wrong with her? Why does she keep crashing and burning? Why can't she stay sober? Why can't she pull her life together? To the point where, like you said, I get it now, you know? And I think that that's something we need to understand about a lot of people who are struggling, is that they haven't dealt with their trauma at the appropriate time in treatment or in the appropriate way. And that is we're doing a service as clinicians to our clients by having them relive or regurgitate or retell the trauma before the time is right.
What specifically helps you right now stay sober? You know what? There, for everybody, it's different. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it is different for a lot of people, but I think one of the biggest misconceptions about sober people is that we struggle every day to stay sober. I know that there are many people who do, but then conversely, there are many people who don't. For me, it is not a daily struggle to remain sober. I do not ever wake up in the morning thinking, crap, how am I going to get through the day without a drink or some sort of drug? It just doesn't occur to me. I'm very active. I'm very engaged. I have a beautiful colleagues at my work. I love my job. I love working with others. I look forward to when I used to wake up in the morning with my brow furrowed and go, oh, crap, another day, you know? And now I wake up and I'm like, oh, my God, another day. Life is just really beautiful when you let it be. So what do I do? I mean, I do the next indicated right thing, and that gets me where I'm going.
How do you deal with your own symptoms? You know, everyone has different symptoms of their trauma.
Well, you know, I think that when the symptoms come up, it's very important to remember the limbic system, you know, the limbic system and the amygdala, which, you know, whatever, know that it is a memory and it's not happening now. Like if my trauma gets triggered, I need to bring my limbic system online to remind myself that this is old. It's not now, and to breathe through it. I mean, the breath is one of the greatest tools that we've been given as beings. You know, if I monitor my breath in a moment of activated trauma, if I look around and identify things in a room, like, oh, look at that lamp over there. That's an interesting chair. I will come back into my body, and I will realize that I'm having a memory, you know?
Do you meditate?
I do a little bit of meditation, not a lot. I'm working mm-hmm. towards doing more. I do meditation mm-hmm. with the clients, you know, every morning. So, but as far as having my own personal practice, not currently. I have in the past.
What's hard about it for you? Because I personally have found it to be a big challenge with the mass majority of people I deal with for a lot of reasons. One is it's a foreign concept to so many people. The addictive mind goes fast. They want something now, and they've got to kind of be spinning on that gerbil wheel. And to just be, whether you're doing transcendental meditation a la David Lynch, or you're mm-hmm. doing mindfulness practice like Thich Nhat Hanh or whatever, it's a different kind of experience. And just to listen to yourself, you know, to go inward, to be silent, it's a wild experience, you know. Did you find that for yourself?
You asked me what was hard about it, but I never said that it was hard for me. It's not hard. Ah. It's just not something that I'm currently engaged in. I love meditation, and I believe that you know, quite often people think that meditation is just, you know, someone sitting cross-legged in a corner all by themselves in the quiet. But I do. I don't do traditional meditation. You know, I believe that anything can be a meditation. I believe a wonderful shower can be a meditation. You know, there's walking meditation. I have a brother who's a devotee of Yogananda, and you know he meditates for many hours a day. And he once said to me, he said, "Sis, you know, I've watched you ironing. That's a meditation for you. That is meditative. When you do that, you're in a meditative state. You know, and so you can make anything meditative as long as you're mindful of what you're doing while you're doing it. It can become meditative." And so that's the way I talk about it with the people that I work with. And when I'm introducing meditation to them, you know, we'll go for a walking meditation, you know, or do something like that because they're like, "Oh, these thoughts keep coming." And I'm like, "That's okay. Wave at the thoughts, tell them hello, and let them slide on by. You know, give the monkey mind a job. The monkey mind's job is to monitor the breath, monitor the breath, monitor the breath."
I love it. And when you're working with these wonderful, wonderful people at the center, is it difficult for them to come to grips with the trauma in their life? Have you found that to be something that is a challenge for so many of these people?
Well, when you say come to grips with, I mean, you know, I think they're all...
be aware of it?
Well, I mean, I think a lot of them don't even think that it was traumatic because, you know, we are what we know. So this is the way I was
exactly.
raised. This is just the way it was, you know,
right.
And they don't understand that there's little T trauma and there's big T trauma because we often consider trauma as a singular event, something shocking, something sudden, something acute. Whereas, you know, over time, the chronic stress and strain of a difficult family life, you know, or these types of things can be traumatic as well. And, you know, to also remember that trauma is kind of relative. What I might find highly traumatic to you might be like, "Oh, yeah, well, that happens to people," you know. And so it's interesting sort of untangling those wires and finding out, you know, what they consider about their history. You know, do you consider that traumatic? What is trauma to you? What does that word mean? You know, there's a lot of different ways to talk about it. But what I find the most important thing is to not talk about it too soon.
Isn't that interesting? Because a lot of people, you know, have done exactly the opposite. And you just said that, you know, whipping it out on the table. But instead allowing people, you know, when you're first going into rehab, you know, detox itself is very tough.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just physiologically, psychologically, it's tough, you know, and you know that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then to have to go to that next step of trying to get your brain CEO back on track again, you know, the frontal lobe, mm-hmm. To try to engage it, get organized, start to be able to assume of a very different kind of reality day by day, instead of just seeking a high, but it's going to a different place. It's interesting as you're looking at all that, and then to begin to address that which, you know, helped to instigate the whole slippery slope with addictive self-soothing behavior, which occurs in so many people. That's a tough one. And, you know, well, this is a challenge.
Of course, yeah,
you know, the work
tough.
You're doing is tough.
Very challenging. I mean, because if drugs and alcohol are but a symptom of a deeper underlying issue, what is the issue, and when is it appropriate to pick at it? You know what I mean? Because if you pick it, it'll never heal.
I know.
Yeah.
And this is where, you know, it's a delicate dance. It's a very delicate dance. And that's why the work you do is so extraordinarily challenging, but it's got to be like ridiculously rewarding when you see someone who begins to get it, when you get that little glow in their eye and they're like, whoa, you know?
Yeah, you know,
I'm hitting I've been at
Breathe Life Healing Center here in West Hollywood for just about a year, and before that I was at another treatment center working for several years. And my first client ever at Breathe is celebrating a year of recovery coming up very shortly. And there is just no greater joy than to see someone thrive, to see someone get it, to see someone wake up. And it's just pretty beautiful. I'm so grateful that I get to do this work. I don't have to do this work. I get to do it.
Oh, how interesting. What a beautiful way to put it. You know, it's a gift. It really is.
Yep.
And how do you, when people out there are, you know, looking at this whole issue, how do you define the recovery process? It's a lifelong thing. And so you never stop being an addict. It's something that you've come to manage, to understand, to seek healthier ways of soothing oneself. How do you reframe that? How do you define it?
Well, I mean, all of the above. That's pretty much why I wrote Hopeful Healing, is that people don't really understand what addiction recovery is like. And people who are even in it, they think it's just go to a meeting and get a sponsor. Well, you know, because physical abstinence is one thing, right? Anyone can put the plug in the jug, you know, or break the tip off the needle, whatever, however you want to put it.
Right.
That, and there's nothing wrong with that. That's absolutely beautiful. Physical abstinence is courageous, important, and beautiful. But then that's when, you know, you really get to start feeling the gifts of recovery, because there's sobriety and then there's recovery. And there's a journey between sobriety, from sobriety to recovery. And that's what I try to talk about in Hopeful Healing, for people who might be curious about what addiction is, how it manifests. And when I say addiction, I'm also including alcohol addiction. I've just sort of lumped them together. Because they pretty much manifest and behave in the same way, you know. And so I wrote Hopeful Healing for a lot of different people and a lot of different reasons, and I think it's appropriate for a lot of, even people who are just curious about me might enjoy it. People who are curious about what is addiction. People who might be interested in bringing some wisdom-based traditions and concepts into their life might really enjoy this. So it's not just for people in recovery. Be very useful,
yeah, I mean,
for loved ones.
I love it. Well, you know, I mean, I'm a shameless fan of yours. And
aww, thank you.
You know, I mean, you know, I'm just, you know, I'm going to make you blush and everything. but seriously, and you've been so transparent and authentic. This book, I think it took it even further, because it really shows an evolution in who you are. You know, you're now a professional within this field, the addiction field. You're someone who's touching people's lives one by one, and now, of course, with the book, one by a million, and it goes on. And, you know, I love what you wrote here when you at the very end, it said, well, you know, but change I did, and I continue to be open to change. I don't always like it. but I remain open to it anyway. I want to live free and clear, open and willing, ready to love and to receive love. If I'm loaded, I lose it all.
Wow. And I am currently sitting at the desk where I wrote those words. I'm sitting in my office to breathe. And I am sitting here at the desk in front of the computer where I wrote those final words of hopeful healing. Yeah.
Stop it. Oh, my God.
I love it. It's powerful.
No, seriously. I just totally love it because, again, one of the things I really love about this book is it truly is. It's like you're sitting here in the living room and we're all having a convo, right? And you're just,
yes, exactly.
You're just being very, you know, like, hey, you know, this is me. And you know certain pieces of me. You've seen them on celluloid. And you followed my life in many respects. But there were pieces of it you never knew. And then when I imploded, this is why I imploded. And I'm being transparent because I want to help people. I want people to understand
exactly.
that through my own understanding, I'm going to help you do the same thing. And let's just keep the gift that keeps on giving. Does that make sense? Because that's what I got
beautiful.
Out of it.
I love the way you put that. Absolutely. I love it.
Yeah. And the trauma thing. Now, you know, I'm going to drag you into something. I mean, I forewarned you that child abuse per se and trauma is a huge interest of mine for a multitude of reasons. And I'm on the board of Child Help. It's actually one word with a capital C and capital H. And we happen to be one of the biggest nonprofits in child abuse in the country with treatment centers, and it goes on and on. We're actually going to be building a Child Help city. Which is really going to be extraordinary on 200 acres.
Wow.
With everything. We have ambassadors. Tag, you're it, Mackenzie.
Okay.
Because you know something? We need to have a lot more people like you who are making the connection between abuse and addiction. I'm sorry, but you have to. And it's a huge connection. And you know, you've got to ask those questions. You've got to follow them. It's not enough to just throw them into foster care or get them a new whatever back and forth. Wait a minute. They're at high risk and vulnerability for running into problems with self-soothing, with, you know, substances and other things.
Or
so,
sex or, you know,
or
many,
anything.
Many
process
things.
Addiction,
yeah.
Substance addiction. I mean, you know, a lot of people use the term cross addiction or transfer addiction. You know, you just mm-hmm. hop from one to the other. So you're off
exactly.
the coke, you're off the alcohol, but you get into sex and you get into gambling and you get, you know, food, whatever. And so it's a real totality here of being able to rein in and say, wait, there are ways everyone needs self-soothing. I mean, we all do, you know, having a rough day. I mean, come on. You know,
right.
So there are really healthy ways of doing that. Pick up a phone, call someone, yap away, right? Take a long walk, run, you know, pet your dog, take your dog out for the long walk and run, whatever. But, you know, listen to music. But you don't have to go to the other place where,
that's
you know,
right.
we start
but I think,
becoming
you know,
self-destructive.
But it has to be on the front line because we don't want to fix broken adults. We want to empower children.
Oh, my gosh. Absolutely. And we want to start early. We want them to understand that we got their back. We're going to help guide them. That's why I love, you know, working within that sector because this is huge. And by the way, it's everywhere. You know, bullying, I'm sorry, is abuse. Verbal
abuse.
Yeah. And all of that. And so it's not just, you know, the more horrific pictures. It's everything. And I see so many kids out there being touched by this, and it's just setting them up for self-destructive self-soothing.
Absolutely. So,
you know,
I will give you my email address and we will have a conversation about getting involved.
Oh man, I'm all over it. I mean, trust me. And we'll get you involved yesterday, to say the least. It's going to be so exciting. Okay. You see, Mackenzie, you wrote the book, and now we're going to take hopeful healing to the children.
There you go.
Yeah, that's what it's all about.
God bless the little children.
Oh, yeah. Everyone out there, we've been talking to Mackenzie Phillips, the actress who has written this, her second book, Hopeful Healing, Essays on Managing Recovery and Surviving Addiction, an absolute must for anyone touched by the issue of addiction and recovery, and quite frankly, for anyone, period, who just wants to understand how to adapt and adjust to life's ever-changing horizon and panorama of stresses and challenges, especially when you're dipping into negative behavior and self-destruction, because there are so many practical ways to be able to get around this and ways of becoming introspective and soothing, gentle ways of taking those very, very first steps toward your own lifelong recovery. And it works that way. Mackenzie, eternal gratitude for this beautiful interview that I know a boatload of people are going to be listening to.
Thank you so much, Pam.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, my goodness gracious. Everyone out there, Mackenzie, you are just amazing. Mackenzie Phillips, the author of Hopeful Healing, Essays on Managing Recovery and Surviving Addiction. Everyone, remember to catch all of our episodes of Her. Just hit subscribe on iTunes or on our show page at RadioMD.com and leave that wonderful rate and review. I read them, love them, and we love your feedback. I'm Dr. Pam Peek. Follow me on Twitter at PamPeekMD. And you can also check out our Her show page at RadioMD.com. Check out all of our past episodes when you get there. Thanks for listening and stay well.